from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to do an in-depth look at cancer risk from CT scans, CAT scans. Special information from Andrea Levy. And more importantly, we're going to show you what you can do to prevent some of the damaging effects of radiation if you do have to have radiation at any point. Also, we're going to look at New York State because we're inching closer to a mandatory GM labeling bill. Most people are not aware of this. It's Bill 617B and would require mandatory labeling of food made with genetically modified organisms. And it doesn't leave it up to big food makers' whims to label food if they feel so inclined. Now, we've won in many states. We've lost barely in California, Washington, Oregon, Colorado. So it's important that all the people listening who are listening from New York State, that you listen up on this. Also, today we're going to look at if you have sex on a regular basis, what will that do for your health? An interesting new study. Also, men with erectile dysfunction, some new information. We're also going to look at how the sun could knock out electrical grids worldwide, something that is inevitable. We just don't know when, but we're going to hear from a leading scientist on that. Also today, for those who believe that Hillary Clinton deserves the black vote, well, not so fast. Michelle Alexander and others within the black community who speak on behalf of the black community say, let's take an honest look at what you've actually done to the blacks, especially poor blacks. We'll hear that. We'll also take a look at a whistleblower. Now he's a deceased journalist, Gary Webb. I knew Gary Webb very well. Today you'll hear him describe how the government and the CIA deliberately flooded lower-class neighborhoods of southern central Los Angeles with heroin and then crack to fund an illegal war in South America. That'll tie into my guest today. My guest is Roger Stone. Roger is a renowned political consultant. He was a lobbyist, a GOP campaign strategist, and he worked as a senior staffer on 8 national elections, including President Nixon, Reagan, George Bush Sr., and he was the keeper of the Nixon's flame during Nixon's post-presidential years, serving as Nixon's man in Washington. But he turned. He got out of that because what he saw, we're going to ask him about that, but more importantly, today, you will see inside the Bush dynasty. He believes, it's his belief, Roger Stone's, that they are no different than an organized crime family. True or not, we'll let him make his case. But also, he's going to tell us about drugs coming in the United States and the Clintons and allegedly the Bushes. That'll be an interesting discussion. Also, the return of crisis. Everywhere you look, if you look honestly, you're going to see that the banks are in deep trouble. Why should you care? I'll explain. Deflation. I'll also talk about how in Canada, how's that working out for you? The $8 cauliflower. Oh, that's because of the pain of falling oil prices. Did you ever figure that maybe destroying your environment, invading and using native land was unethical, immoral, unconscionable? It's called karma. In Canada, you're about to get a lot more of it, and I'll explain how. Why the black hole of deflation is swallowing the entire world, even after central banks have pumped trillions into the economy. The truth about our economy today. Also a segment, a man down in Houston got a knock on the door. There were seven fully armed U.S. Marshals. They arrested him, booked him. Turns out he had a student debt, an old student debt of $1,500. So they're arresting people who don't pay their student debts? Oh, yeah. What if you're a senior citizen? What if you're a really old person? It doesn't matter how old you are. And it doesn't matter that you represent no threat. These were U.S. Marshals. They're even sending SWAT teams, and they'll kick in your door. They'll put a gun in your face because you owe debt. So I'm going to have to deal today with our skewed courts teaming up with debt predators to jump on and exploit our nation's poor. Why aren't we talking about corporate courts that have taken from the poor and handed to the rich? As you see, we have a lot to share. Let's begin. First up, oh, and by the way, for those of you who are traveling, you can always listen to this radio program, noon Eastern Standard Time, by dialing the following phone number. Or maybe you're listening on a land-based station, and maybe there's a problem with the signal, or I've been preempted for some reason. I'm always live at noon at this phone number. Please write it down. 712-775-6850. 712-775-6850. Some from Coventry University, that's in the United Kingdom, here's what they say. Having more sex, the older you get, could help stave off dementia. Now we know why there's so many people who are forgetting. You didn't have enough sex. Well, and there's some people who should never have dementia because they don't stop. So the idea is this, quote, those age 50 who were still active in the bedroom had sharper cognitive function. That's a new study. And were better able to recall lists and recognize patterns, both of which are signs of a healthier brain. So we know that sex is good for your muscles. We know it's good for endorphins. We know it's great for sharing oxytocin. But now it's good for the brain. So that's one prescription that will make a difference. And this is based upon 850,000 people who were found to have dementia in this particular study. Healthy sex, healthy mind, healthy body. Also, a lot of men suffer from erectile dysfunction. I remember when Fox News and MSNBC were first announcing the discovery and promotion of Viagra. And they had all these urologists on talking about what a wonderful thing it was and how it would help people. So I just simply looked at the scientific literature, including the manufacturer's own package insert, and found, hold on, there's a whole lot of problems taking this, and you're not looking at the underlying cause, as if the underlying cause is inevitable. It's not. There's three principal reasons that men have erectile dysfunction. Number one, and most important, poor circulation. I was thinking about this morning, and trying to explain it to a young graduating class of high school students. How do you explain in a context that they could understand that every choice they have made up to that point or will make after that point will end up meeting them at some point in their life? For example, you're never going to smoke a pack of cigarettes and end up with lung cancer, or have a glass of hard whiskey and end up with cirrhosis of the liver, or end up eating some French fries and hot dogs and hamburgers and end up with colorectal cancer, breast cancer, prostate cancer. But do that enough times and absolutely you're going to end up having a collapse of a system. You just don't know when, and you don't know what that magic number of how many times you can abuse yourself before the body can no longer repair the damage. So for people who are vital and healthy and who only see wonderful things happening each day, that's a hard message to learn. Once you're talking with someone sitting across from you who's been diagnosed with terminal cancer and given just days or months to live, it's a whole lot easier for them to appreciate that message. For someone who has not yet been diagnosed with a terminal illness, has not yet had the heart attack or stroke, it's a little more challenging, but at least they're aware of its possibilities. So the idea is that everything that we eat that is pro-inflammatory, everything we drink, including coffee, that is pro-inflammatory or highly acidic, that creates cytokines, it creates tumor necrosis factor alpha, it creates prostaglandins, all of which, and many others, are pro-inflammatory. The inflammation at the cellular level causes DNA to be damaged. Sometimes we can repair the damage. The younger we are, we can repair more. The older we get, the less we can repair. It doesn't mean we can't repair it. It just means that you really have to work on it and you can't cheat. But what we never repair is the epithelium because we're unaware of it. This is the lining of our arteries. Whoever thinks of the lining of their arteries? No one. But every time you have something that's damaging, you cause little nicks and cuts and scrapes. The body tries to scab it, just like it would on your skin. And then that scab can break off and become part of a clot. So your arterial walls become hard. They calcify. That's why we call it arterial sclerosis. They become inefficient at distributing blood and nutrients in the blood. That's atherosclerosis. And that is a primary cause of erectile dysfunction. Because when you clean up a person's arteries, which you can, and you rebuild the epithelium, which you can, then I've seen people overcome erectile dysfunction if it was due to poor circulation. Separately, and people never discuss this, for most people at a certain point, sex is repetitive. It's a ritual. It's perfunctory. It's obligatory. But that doesn't mean that it's exciting. That means to make it exciting, you have to put imagination. You have to be able to have mental sex, because probably after the age of, let's say, 30, 95% of sex is in the mind. It's the mind that makes it exciting. Hence the idea of sex talks and images and fantasies, etc. And being with people who either are facilitators or who are understanding. But historically, think of this. Think of historically and around the world today. I'm willing to guesstimate that probably somewhere between 60 and 80% of all women in the world today are never encouraged to have happy sex, never encouraged to maximize their sexual potential. They're supposed to simply accept that they are a vehicle for the man's sexual pleasure. Their pleasure, their excitement, their enjoyment is considered not only not important, but a threat. In fact, there was a time in the United States where if a woman showed any interest in orgasm or foreplay, anything at all that would please her, that was grounds for considering her suffering from hysteria or what was called womb fury, in which case a person could be institutionalized if they were argumentative or if they had a desire for sex and their ovaries removed, in some cases their clitoris removed. That is around the world, has been. Last week I did a program on sexual mutilation. Hundreds of millions of principally young girls are sexually mutilated. Thousands die every year. And yet it hasn't stopped in the cultures, hasn't even slowed down. By the way, nor has killing babies, girls, in India and also in much of China. Major genocide. We're talking about not millions or tens of millions. We're up into the hundreds of millions, and yet it's a topic that is never discussed. Why not? In any case, the whole idea is sex should be playful, exciting, adventurous, and that is what most guys just don't have, especially once they're through their primary stage of excessive hormone, testosterone stimulation. then it's, you know, it doesn't get interesting for most people. And so you start encouraging men and their partners to be playful, to be imaginative, to bring excitement back in. Suddenly they no longer have erectile dysfunction. How's it going? Not a problem. So what was the difference? Well, the difference is before I didn't think of sex as something I could actually actively create and be a part of. Now I do. So that's the difference. And the last cause that I have seen in men that I've counseled is depression. A sense of feeling lost. Especially in men who are in their 40s or 50s who are out of their principal career, or they're insecure, they've lost something, maybe a relationship they've had, a marriage, they feel adrift. They don't feel anchored. They don't have something in life they believe worth living for. And almost always you will see erectile dysfunction, a complete loss of interest in sex altogether. So what can we do to help the men with erectile dysfunction, from no matter what the underlying cause? First, don't just look at relieving the symptoms with the drugs, because a lot of those drugs can kill you and do. Men have heart attacks. We should have counseling centers that, using the enormous mindset of retired people who are knowledgeable about human conditions. Think of all the psychoanalysts, psychotherapists, psychologists, humanist philosophers who could give guidance to men, even by phone. And that's something I believe we should consider. I think that would be a terrific service. And also then spread it out. And if it works, then do it for teenagers who are in crisis of some form or another and don't know who to speak with. Maybe they fear talking with their parents or can't. And then for women. And then for senior citizens, so many of whom are abandoned, lonely, and just waiting to die. That's not a way to live. And we have more than enough solutions and resources and positive people. We're just not organized. We don't have it together. That's something to consider. Next up, I want to talk about flavonoids and heart health benefits. This is in the University of East Anglia, as well as St. Andrews and Westminster Universities in the United Kingdom, published in the Journal of Nutrition. They found that the cardiovascular benefits of flavonoids, Flavon, F-L-A-V-O-N, oids, O-I-D-S, and the foods that are rich in flavonoids, that would be onions right at the top of the list. It would be blueberries, raspberries, strawberries, blackberries, black currants, mulberries, gooseberries, goji berries, mangosteen, noni berry. All of those are rich in flavonoids. And they have a lot of benefits to your health, to your heart. They're strongly anti-inflammatory, and they help with the vascular cellular health. So make sure that you're getting them into your diet on a regular basis. And also, from the Salk Institute for Biological Studies, there is a nutrient in cucumbers that can help prevent memory loss. The results of a recent study are offering new hope that avoiding memory loss related to aging as well as Alzheimer's disease can be as simple as eating more cucumbers. Now, I never suggest for myself that one nutrient or one food is that spectacular. But I look at it as just adding in one more piece to the puzzle, one more nutrient, one more food, one more type of juice to everything else we're doing. So I'll make it a lot more broad-based. But they're saying, no, this is the cucumber. And researchers working, in this case, with mice that normally develop the symptoms of Alzheimer's, including memory loss, discovered that a daily dose of flavanol called, and I've told you this before, let me spell it for you, fisetin, F-I-S-E-T-I-N, prevented these and other related impairments. And this improvement occurred despite the continued formation of amyloid plaques, which are the brain proteins commonly blamed for Alzheimer's. And where do you get this? You get it in the flavanol is principally in cucumbers. So the takeaway message is protecting the neurons, the brain from aging. Make sure you have that cucumber juice. Remember I suggested to have cucumbers with green apple and celery. Oh, and another food that's very rich in fisetin, strawberries. So why not have strawberries, green apple, and cucumbers? That's a good juice, and that can help you. And the omega-3 fatty acids lead to, quote, clinically meaningful blood pressure reduction. This, again, is from the University of East Anglia, Reading University, Southampton University, Glasgow University, and Newcastle University. And it was published in the journal Nutrition. And, quote, from the study, consuming the DHA omega-3 fatty acids at doses as low as 0.7 grams per day, I would suggest three times that amount, by the way, about 2,000 to 3,000 milligrams a day, 2 to 3 grams a day, produce clinically meaningful reductions in systolic blood pressure. So, for those of you who have elevated blood pressure, a whole lot of new research shows that it can make a big difference in lowering blood pressure naturally. And that is very important. So that's the latest on health and healing. I'm Gary Nall. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
If you want something to play with, go and find yourself a toy. Baby, my time is too expensive, and I'm not a little boy.
I'd like to welcome all of you who are listening. Just as an aside, anyone in the Los Angeles area, there's a very prestigious, very important film festival, and we won Best Documentary. I can't get out there. In fact, this is one of those unusual years. I believe we're over 60, that's 60, for Just Poverty, Inc. And wherever I can in my travels, I'll drop in. And I always really enjoy meeting the directors and producers and writers of different films, especially the independent film festivals. And we just won at the Impact Documentary Awards. And that's out there in La Jolla, California. But we'll post where these awards are going to be held on my Facebook. And if you live in that area, we'll talk with you and you can go. And it's a nice awards dinner. And you can get up there and pick up the award and ship it off to New York. At least you have a chance to be there rather than them saying, well, Gary's not here because I'm on the road. I just can't get to these awards. But we've got a lot of awards festivals, and they're a lot of fun to go to. You meet a lot of interesting people. And we're having a banner year with Poverty, Inc. So we'll post on my Facebook, and then you can see if that's a place that you can go to. Doesn't cost you anything, and it's fun. Now, I want to play a short part of Dr. Suzanne Humphreys, because yesterday when we played part one of her work called Manufacturing Consent on the safety and efficacy of vaccines, she's talking about the politics of it. We were just inundated with people who said they appreciated that insight, information. They didn't know about this. They didn't know about the politics of vaccines. And so we're going to play you another short clip today.
Not only are all children getting two shots, but adults like myself are being told to revaccinate because our vaccines have worn off. There's an obvious problem when we see the proportion of infected people from California. In the pre-vaccine era, 95 to 99% of people had lifelong immunity to measles by the age of 15. And infants and less than 1 year olds almost never got infected by measles. But look how many less than 1-year-olds and over 20-year-olds were infected in that California outbreak. 11% were less than 1-year-old. That almost never happened before the vaccine, because naturally immune mothers provide stronger and longer transplacental antibody to protect that baby. Look at how many greater than 20-year-olds were infected, 56%. Again, that would have not happened before the measles vaccines were instituted, because these are the people whose vaccines have worn off. Okay, unless they're not vaccinated, these are the people whose vaccines have worn off. So you're not supposed to know any of this. You're just supposed to believe that vaccines are your responsibility and good for your child and everyone else too. And they say, while it may seem mean to give a 2-month-old baby 6 vaccines in one day, it's actually kind. In the past, parents could just quietly opt out of vaccines, but today, parents have to justify themselves more than ever. Thinking and doing your own research is discouraged, and most people just go right along with it. When it comes to vaccines, history is perceived as the greatest judge of success. The pro-vaccine say that because some vaccines were so good, that all vaccines in the future must be even better. They tell a vaccine history which only admits to a few minor glitches, just to make you think that they're being transparent. Yet when you look deeper, lots of skeletons fall out of lots of closets. Most of the vaccine history given to the public is carefully cherry-picked data that rarely mentions anything nasty that happened in the real world related to vaccination. So it's much easier to bury one's head than to face the uncomfortable truth. Most people just want reassurance that what they believed and did was the right thing and not based on any fallacies. The result? Compliant people with sick children regularly running to the doctor, getting vaccines and filling prescriptions. Doctors and parents now think that 9 antibiotic prescriptions in the first year of life is normal. They have no idea what a really healthy child looks like. As a medical doctor specializing in nephrology, which is kidneys, for nearly 2 decades, and as a vaccinator and prescription writer, it looked like sickness normally started in adulthood to me. In my pediatric rotations decades before, I saw what normal was then, but 20 years later, what's considered normal is a lot sicker than it was back then. Even worse, I now see the pediatric kidney failure population increasing rapidly. Parents notice their kids get sick after vaccinations, and they're tired of hearing that it was just coincidence. In my last 10 years, I lived in a state in the United States where a relatively high number of people did not vaccinate. That allowed me to see children who were shockingly vibrant and healthy. They hardly ever got sick, and when they did, they got over it quickly. Those parents rarely needed a doctor. They nursed their children back to health without the usual blunt weapons of antibiotics and fever reducers. After I left the medical system, I looked more closely at why those children were so healthy. And I became frustrated that the medical system does not focus more on healthy children when they see them for school physicals, because that's just about the only time they see them, unless they fall down and cut themselves or break a bone, whereupon they're berated for not being vaccinated instead of having the problem dealt with. Those doctors should be asking, what are these parents doing right to have this level of health? Why are they different? Most of you are here today because what you see or what you have experienced doesn't line up with the message of the system. You don't want to live with your head in the ground. So what do you do? When doctors and health officials define good as meaning compliant. There are articles which state that the never vaccinated children are rarely seen in the system, but that's usually attributed to parental distrust of the system rather than lack of need. It's hard for the pro-vaccine to concede that never vaccinating children rarely actually need the system, but that's certainly what I've witnessed. When non-vaccinators are kicked out of the office, doctors then turn around and say that the other forms of healing that those parents turn to are quackery, dangerous, and can kill you because you aren't using their medicine. Well, fortunately, many intelligent parents see that the medical system is fear-mongering. Some parents today have great-grandparents who laugh when measles is called something more dangerous than Ebola. I've noticed that once parents have enough knowledge and experience, they no longer feel doctor-dependent because they realize how easy it is to not need doctors. And this works so long as parents have the freedom to choose. And the medical system knows that, which is why they're now turning up the heat. While non-vaccinating parents are treated with disdain, what happens when a previously compliant parent wakes up and asks this simple question? Why did all these problems start after those vaccines? The doctor automatically rejects the connection. If the parent persists in their questioning, rejection becomes disdain and hostility. The angry doctor may call them paranoid, neurotic, stupid, unqualified, hysterical, or dangerous. I've been treated with that same hostility and told that I have blood on my hands. What critics choose to ignore is that my decades within the hospital system, I willingly signed vaccine orders and gave them myself, believing that I was preventing sickness. It came as a total shock to me when I started to realize that vaccines I administered were causing serious health issues in my patients. I understand the doctor's viewpoint. I had a choice. I could either tell my patients that their suspicions were coincidence or do a really thorough case review while researching on PubMed. I chose to fully investigate and to support my patients instead of protecting my ego, my position, my pride, or my bank account. And after 6 years of solid research in PubMed literature, looking at information which was never given to me when I was educated within the system, I can see that when I was a vaccinator, I had inadvertent blood on my hands. Science and logic have brought me to where I am today. Everything I say is right there in the medical literature. Yet academia would rather shoot the messenger than discuss the message or consider the sickness record of vaccinated children. I don't have a vaccine-injured child. This isn't personal for me. So why would I give up a highly paid job and an excellent reputation just to talk about vaccines? Why would I continue to research this controversial subject just to be subjected to the hostility that I am? A few years ago, I stood back to make a scientific analysis of the big picture. And that's when I discovered that the medical system sometimes tolerates independent thinking, but they don't encourage anything that disturbs the status quo. We are told the science is settled on everything vaccine. But as I compared the so-called evidence with the historical and scientific literature, it became clear that the education given to me and to doctors today is an oppressive form of religion, preached as gospel by...
And that was just the second part of what will be a 10-part series just on her, and we have 20 additional scientists and physicians sharing insights on vaccines. This is for those people who still remain pro-vaccine to offer them a different perspective. I'm Gary Knoll. A few things on the risks of CAT scans. This is from Andrew Levy, new research, and thank you, Andrew, for sharing your facts with us. The reality is this. Every year, Americans are exposed to unsafe levels of DNA-altering radiation through medical imaging such as CT scans. How many? 72 million CT scans are performed annually in the United States, which is about one for every four people in the country. Why is this so troubling? Because the radiation in that CT scan can increase your risk of cancer. The National Cancer Institute researchers now estimate that those 72 million CAT scans could account for roughly 29,000 future cancer cases each year. Or another way of looking at it is that roughly every 400 to 2,000 routine scans, one new cancer case will occur because of the actual procedure. So these are not safe. They give you a lot of ionizing radiation, and that in turn damages the DNA. In addition, regular consumption of these X-rays, like a chiropractic X-ray, those at least who do them, not all do, which are not necessary, and a lot of other x-rays contribute to the full body burden. So CAT scans, in my opinion, are bad to the bone. Just let me give you the overview. First of all, anytime you expose yourself to ionizing radiation, which is growing rapidly in the United States, you increase DNA damage. And ionizing radiation produces reactive compounds that directly damage cells that cause DNA strand breaks, leading to cancer formation. And studies show that exposure to a CT or CAT scan can increase the risk of cancer by at least 24%, and that those risks last for years after the test is completed. So you get a CAT scan today, and you may not find the cancer appearing in your body for 10 or 20 years, but it's there. So what can we do about it? Where is the good part of this? Well, the good part is there's new research showing that you can take blueberries, and that will enhance DNA repair. That's very important, the fact that we can change the genetic damage inflicted by ionizing radiation, and in a big way. Also, there are other things that the new research shows, including lemon balm reduces production of reactive chemical compounds by radiation, helping cells to retain their integrity. Ginkgo biloba reduces DNA damage that can lead to cancer. Spirulina supports bone marrow production of white and red blood cells, protecting against the risk of infection. So ginkgo, lemon balm, spirulina, blueberries, yeah, all these are important and they help. In fact, lemon balm, there's a lot of science on lemon balm. Lemon balm can boost levels of the superoxide dismutase, or SOD, which is an essential component of the body's native ability to protect itself from the effects of ionizing radiation. And lemon balm defends lipid cell membranes. Remember, most of your brain is made up of lipids. And lemon balm has shown a sharp reduction in the lipid peroxidation that is a measure of direct cell damage. Lemon balm also protects your DNA, and that's important. And ginkgo is well known for its ability to protect cells from the DNA breaking. And so, all good. Spirulina is simply one of the best things in the world that you can take for overall health and detoxification, but new research shows it protects us as well. For those of you living in New York State, there is a bill, A617B. That's Assembly Bill 617B, which would require mandatory labeling of food made with genetic materials. If you're not fully up on why you should support a GMO labeling bill, then please watch on my website, Seeds of Death. And Seeds of Death, by the way, was shown on PBS station in Denver dozens of times, and leading up to the vote there. And it was shown out in the state of Washington, and it's shown all over the country, where people want to rally people to the truth of the dangers of GMOs. And it's the most watched film ever produced on genetically and engineered food. It's called Seeds of Death. You can watch it for free and then pass it on and send it to our legislators. Let every legislator and the governor in New York State get a copy of Seeds of Death. Educate yourself, educate others, share the information. Word of mouth makes a difference. Again, the assembly bill that we should all be voting on in New York State, A617B, requiring mandatory labeling of food made with genetically modified organisms. So let's win this one and join Vermont and Connecticut in labeling our products. I'm Gary Knoll. We're going to take a brief break. When we come back, we're going to have our guest on the line, and we're going to talk about the Bush dynasty and some really serious allegations, and we'll ask, what's your evidence? We only want evidence that could appear in a court of law, because it's serious allegations. But if it's true, wow, will that reshape some people's perceptions and give them a better perspective on some incidents, including 9/11? Please stay with us. Back in a moment.
Walking in rain.
Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Nall, on the road. You'll see what I'm doing when I get back into the city. We're going to have a whole lot of filming that will be made available on important social and public health issues to share starting in about 3 weeks. But now we're going down to Washington, D.C. Standing by is Roger Stone. I gave you Roger's background at the beginning of the program. He has published articles in the Huffington Post, the Daily Caller. His site is stonezone.com. And he's been profiled numerous programs, newspapers, and articles. And his previous books have focused on the JFK assassination and the Clinton family. His most recent book is Jeb and the Bush Crime Family, The Inside Story of an American Dynasty, which gives a long historical look at the family he claims is corrupt, from great-grandfather Samuel Bush to George Jr. and Jeb Bush today. Nice to have you with us today, Roger.
Gary, delighted to be with you, as always.
Roger, I'm going to ask you this. At any time when making a statement, please understand, as the Bushes are not here to defend themselves, only state what you can prove that we could be entered into a court of law, and so we do not offer anything that is specious or your personal opinion. Fair enough?
I never do.
Okay, good.
My books are very carefully sourced and footnoted and annotated. And as you know, Gary, when you publish a book like this that's controversial, the lawyers for your publisher, the $800 an hour New York lawyers who are experts in libel and slander, believe me, they go through your book with a fine-tooth comb.
Okay, I want to start our interview a little differently. I want to start with a clip from someone who I had an enormous amount of respect for, had many, many conversations with. In fact, I was there when he won his award on Project Censored. It was up at Columbia University, and my publisher, Seven Stories Press, publishes all of the Project Censored books. And we had a nice conversation, and I said to him, Gary, you know they're going to go after you. Anytime you do something that threatens the status quo or any governmental agency, in this case the CIA, they're going to find every way possible to destroy your reputation. Are you prepared for that? And he said, yeah, he is. Okay, this is a very rare interview, rarely ever heard. I had to dig for this. And this is Gary Webb talking about what he found, and you'll see how this ties into my guest, Roger Stone's claims.
Talk about the issues.
It was about a cocaine ring that operated along the west coast of the United States throughout most of the 80s. And they were funneling, they were selling cocaine in South Central, they were also selling it in Oakland, they were selling it in San Francisco, they were selling it in San Jose. And some of the money they were making was going to support an army that the men who ran the cocaine ring worked for, called the FDN. This was an army that the CIA started in 1981 and supported.
Better known to us, most of us who remember the news, the Contras in Nicaragua. So go right ahead.
The men that were running the cocaine ring were top officials of this Contra army. And what we found was that they were selling this stuff in South Central, which is, you know, predominantly black section of Los Angeles, immediately before the outbreak of the crack cocaine epidemic. They started selling powder. Tons and tons and tons of powder cocaine was going into this one small area of the city. And from there, they sold it to Freeway Rick. And Freeway Rick took the powder, turned it into crack, and starting in 1983, 1984, began distributing it to predominantly the gangs, the Crips and the Bloods in Los Angeles. And they spread it, you know, from there.
From there. Now, this since this has happened, you have butted heads with everybody in Washington, D.C., trying to get information about the story, have you not?
Yeah. We worked on this for a year. And it was only because, you know, some people at National Archives believe freedom of information means freedom of information. We got some documents that showed that pretty strongly there were some CIA connections to
this. Let's talk a little bit about those documents for a second. Because there's a gentleman, this figure that we talked about yesterday on the show. His name is Blandone, Danilo Blandone, who was a person who was a member of the aristocracy of Nicaragua before the fall of Somoza. And then he fled and comes to the United States and decides, while he's in the United States, so you can all understand this, he wants to raise money for their revolutionaries who are trying to overthrow the government that just overthrew them. So here in the United States, they try to do fundraisers, and that doesn't work. And then Blandone gets a scheme. Well, I can get some cocaine cheaply. with some help from some of my friends and get it into the United States of America, all I need to find is somebody who can sell it. So they find a gentleman by the name of Rick Ross, who is Freeway Rick. Rick Ross comes in and starts selling cocaine at the terms beginning 1 or 2 grams. And within weeks, 2, 3, 4 kilos a week. Within months, what was it, 10 to 15 kilos a day. Ricky Ross was selling cocaine to the point of making $3 to $4 million a day. He sold so much cocaine, it hurt his fingers to count the money. Not only in Los Angeles, but in Cincinnati, in St. Louis, all the way across America. So some can say, and this is the reason why people are so angry at you in your article, is that Ricky Ross, the dope dealer, was supplied by the CIA because Blandone was an operative for the CIA, correct?
Blandone and Meneses were working for an army that was a wholly owned subsidiary of the CIA. They were meeting with CIA agents. Blandone, and this came out in court. I mean, Danilo Blandone is now a government witness. He works for the Drug Enforcement Administration. And we've paid him, I don't know, $166,000 over the last 18 months because he's such a good informant. So they put him on the witness stand in Ricky Ross's case. And he testified that in 1981, he went to Honduras. He met with the commander, the military commander of the CIA's army. And he was instructed to go raise money in California for this Contra army. And he was told that the ends justified the means.
And those ends being sell cocaine if you
want to. Well, look, he was in the room with the Nicaraguan representative of the Cali cartel, Mr. Meneses, and he was in the room with a government marketing expert named Danilo Blandone. Now, if they weren't talking about selling cocaine, I don't know what they were talking about.
And this is all information they can find on a website. I have to use that website. But on a website on the Internet. So we're going to put that up so people can go
and look at these documents.
Take a look at the documents yourself and judge it. But Michael, now, I mean, there's a stretch here. Here's a guy who is obviously a CIA operative, Mr. Mm-hmm. Blandone, who is working with this government-backed army that we've kind of created in Nicaragua. But how the heck does this guy get to bring in tons of cocaine? When I say tons, I'm talking tons. 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 tons of cocaine weekly in the United States of America for 7 years, and no one can ever catch him.
Well, number one, Mr. Meneses was actually indicted in 1984. He was known within, my own sources in DEA told me, he was known as el rey de la droga, the king of drugs. He was in more than 40 files and indicted mysteriously, and people within DEA say that it was CIA intervention that kept this sealed indictment from ever being opened. So he was well known. He's well known. The connection between him, Blandone, and Calero, who was the head of the Nicaraguan government in exile, is clear. There's a clear evidentiary.
Well, we got a picture of him.
Yeah, there's a clear evidentiary trail. Now, if you want to follow that trail up, you have to first understand how CIA and DEA work. I was a country attaché assigned to Argentina. Now, during those years, there were people who I inherited on the payroll who were murderers. They were also on the CIA.
Okay, that's Gary. That's Gary Webb and Mike Levine on Montel Williams. Okay, so Roger, none of this could have happened without the White House National Security Agency that oversaw the CIA having a hand in it. Tell us about the Clinton participation, whatever you can document, in drug dealing, and the Bush hand in drug dealing, if you have proof of it.
Yeah, I believe everything you just heard is accurate. That's kind of like the end use of drugs. When the Congress outlawed federal assistance, U.S. government assistance to the Nicaraguan Contras in the Boland Amendment, CIA Director Bill Casey and Vice President George Bush, particularly under Bush, headed up a task force, a multi-agency task force, which imported millions of dollars of cocaine into the United States, ultimately to the West Coast, as you just heard. This is documented in Al Martin's book, excellent book. He was a full participant in these activities, also documented in Daniel Hopsker's book. It is, in fact, true that at first the government tried to import drugs through Louisiana, but could not get the cooperation of the governor of Louisiana, nor Louisiana State Police, specifically the superintendent of state police. This is fairly well documented. They then tried to run drugs through Texas. They could not get the operation of the Texas Rangers nor the Texas governor. They ultimately found a malleable governor in Arkansas. Dan Lassiter, longtime associate of Bill Clinton's, was involved in this ring. And the U.S. attorney there, who I interviewed, now governor, had multiple complaints about drugs being trafficked through MENA, Arkansas. L.D. Brown, who was Bill Clinton's bodyguard, in his biography, details going to the rural airport in MENA, poking around, as he puts it, uncovering a catch of cocaine on a flatbed, and then later confronting Governor Bill Clinton about, you know what they're doing out at MENA? They're importing cocaine. To which Clinton said, yeah, that's Dan Lassiter's deal. George Bush knows all about it. So I believe that the Bush-Clinton association and collaboration starts as early as the MENA importation. Now, it's important to recognize that Bill Clinton and George Bush, according to Cord Meyer and his biography, share a common thread in their service to the Central Intelligence Agency. After Bill Clinton was tossed out of Oxford, essentially because he raped a 19-year-old co-ed named Eileen Wellstone, I have interviewed Eileen Wellstone. Her last name is no longer Wellstone. She is still living, now married with children, living in the UK. Bill Clinton never received never earned a degree from Oxford. And after leaving Oxford, but before going to Yale Law School, he spent the summer, essentially, according to Cord Meyer's biography, as an informant for the Central Intelligence Agency, spying on anti-Vietnam War groups in Europe and attending anti-war rallies in Europe. So this is a common thread that the Clintons and the Bushes have in common. It is indisputable. And by the way, not reflected in the recent John Meacham best-selling biography of George H.W. Bush, that he stonewalled the Iran-Contra special prosecutor, that he refused to be questioned about these activities, nor would he turn over any documents. That is findable in the final special report by Lawrence Walsh, who was the special prosecutor in Iran-Contra. And as you know, Gary, ultimately Oliver North would be indicted and then his conviction thrown out in this very operation.
We also had, aside from Dan Lassiter, who was convicted and went to jail for drug dealing in MENA, Arkansas, we had Barry Seal. And Barry Seal was operating without being arrested in MENA, Arkansas, at the airport, running the biggest known drug cocaine import into the United States during his year. But he also was working with the U.S. government, including, it would have been, Bush Sr. at that time.
Yes. In fact, Richard Sharpstein, who was his attorney, was also my attorney, represented me on some civil matters. Sharpstein was interviewed by Daniel Hopsiger. I also interviewed Sharpstein. Sharpstein unfortunately committed suicide, at least according to the Miami Police Department, about a year ago, a little more than a year ago. Sharpstein said that Seal, his client, told him that he was working directly for the vice president. And in order to prove it, he called the vice president's office. He told Sharpstein, call the vice president's office, say you're me, and ask to speak to the vice president. Whereupon Sharpstein called the vice president's office in Washington, D.C., and after a short wait, after asking for the vice president, Admiral Daniel Murphy, Bush's chief of staff and also a longtime CIA hand, picked up the phone and said, Barry, where the hell have you been? We've been looking for you. After which Sharpstein hung up.
Tell us, in the time we have remaining, we're going to have to do this in two parts, but tell us the top stories that you can connect concerning 9/11, the knowledge that the Bushes had about pre-9/11 Saudi financing and Saudi knowledge of that, and how he got the entire Saudi group out of the United States, but no other persons from around the world including heads of government, were allowed to leave the United States, but the Saudis were.
Yeah, I think to understand this, one needs to understand the long backstory regarding the relationship between the Saudis and the Bush family. The Saudis subsidize George H.W. Bush's oil company, Zapata, in the 60s. The Saudis also buy Harkin, the failed oil company of George W. Bush, which really isn't worth much. But the Stevens brothers out of Arkansas go to the international markets in a very cleverly disguised offering to try, and the Saudis ultimately finance, or I should say purchase, Harkin. We also know, working backwards, that 28 pages of the 9/11 Commission report that pertain to Saudi financing of the operation are still to this day redacted. Senator Bob Graham, very courageous, several congressmen have seen these documents and say what they show is the Saudi financing, the Saudi royal family financing of the attack. I interviewed a police officer in Boston, Richard Carrasso, who was called to duty on 9/11 because he was told that there was a private party traveling out of Boston on federal government planes, and he was called in to do additional security. He didn't think much of that because he was sure nobody was flying on 9/11. But when he got there, in fact, members of the bin Laden family were being shuttled onto planes and out of the country. At least two of those who were taken out of the country should have been questioned before they left based on their own connections to international, or I should say Islamic radical terrorism. The government to this day denies that anybody was flown out of the country. Frankly, I'm looking forward to the debate in this presidential campaign because I'm waiting for one of the other candidates, hopefully Donald Trump, to ask Jeb Bush point blank, do you support the release of these documents so that the American people can see who paid for the attack on America in 9/11?
Do you have any hard or prima facie evidence to show that it was the Saudis?
I would rely on the 9/11 Commission. They conducted a full investigation. I have to take the word of those who have read those 28 redacted pages. Senator Graham has read them as a member of the Senate Intelligence Committee. There's a congressman from Utah. So I would have to say, no, it's secondhand. On the other hand, the American people paid for an investigation. Now we have the right to know what the investigation showed.
Final question for today. We will do a more in-depth Progressive Commentary Hour for an hour on this, probably next week. But if you were to cite George W. Bush for one particularly egregious problem that he brought, we're not talking about 9/11, we're not talking about war in Iraq now, that the public would not know about, that the media has not covered, but you have dug up and have presented, what would that egregious act be?
It's a very, very tough question because there's so much there that is objectionable, whether it is the big bank bailouts, the massive spending, the mishandling of 9/11. Look, we know that several of the 9/11 hijackers trained in Tampa, Florida. We know, based on terrific reporting by Dan Christensen at the Broward Bulldog and others, that that there were multiple complaints to the local and state police from people in Tampa saying something strange is going on. These strange men are doing something. We also knew that people were being trained to fly airplanes into buildings. Somehow, the intelligence agencies under George W. Bush never connected the dots. And one has to wonder why. It is very clear that Condoleezza Rice had numerous tips. It is very clear that George Tenet, the CIA director, had numerous tips, yet nothing was done to prevent the attack. I think that that is the most egregious failure of the George W. Bush administration, because they had the pieces, but they never assembled them. And by the way, when George Tenet left the government, you know what we did? We gave him a medal.
George, Roger Stone, thank you for being on today to give us just an insight of what will be a comprehensive one-hour discussion. And we're going to go back during that one-hour discussion to the very beginning, to the Bushes that the public is not aware of, clear back to the great-grandfather and the Nazi Association, and bring it right up through the current times. We look forward to that. My guest, Roger Stone, and he is the author of a new important book, Jeb and the Bush Crime Family, The Inside Story of an American Dynasty. And I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow.